Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mehler here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at Wisconsin's innovations and inventions and everything from the iconic to the very much unexpected, all yours to see when you visit the Wisconsin Historical Museum in Madison. We have a couple of guys here who have put together an exhibit at the museum. And I tell you what, it's fascinating. We've come up with a whole lot of things. I haven't come up with anything, but a whole lot of people from Wisconsin, where with Wisconsin roots, have had some startling innovations. We'll talk with Dave Driscoll and Joe Kapler about those innovations. And certainly, have you joined in with your own questions or comments? Is there a Wisconsin discovery or invention that you are particularly proud of? What do you tell your non-Wisconsin friends and family about when they ask you about what about Wisconsin? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show and you can post a question or comment there. Dave Driscoll, curator of business and technology at the Wisconsin Historical Museum, one of our guests. Dave, thank you for coming by.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Joe Kapler. Joe is curator of domestic life at the Wisconsin Historical Museum, and thank you for coming by as well.
Good morning, Larry.
How's the museum funded? What's the museum all about? What's its purpose, Dave?
Well, you asked a couple of different questions. Our purpose is to collect and exhibit artifacts, material culture that illuminates the experience of Wisconsin residents throughout the years to kind of look at what makes Wisconsin a special place.
Yeah, and you've come up with a kind of a new exhibit, mm-hmm. that is pretty fun and pretty, at least according to Judith. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, was there this weekend. I haven't been yet, but believe me, after listening to her talk about the museum and what's going on there, I've got to take my wife and daughter. We got to go there. Joe, what about it?
Certainly. To get back to your first question about funding, Historical Society is a state agency, and we are grateful for the support of the state paying for us, our staff, our lights, electricity, all those things. And then we also rely generously on folks out there in community foundations and groups and companies to help us fund initiatives like mm-hmm. something like this, a major exhibition. And we're really happy for that. To get to the exhibit specifically, there is some fun in it too, but there's also a lot of, as our exhibit designer likes to say, there's a lot of meat and potatoes and vegetables in there too.
Well, you know, you've got all these different areas, entertainment, sports and culture, health and medicine. What else is there? Farming and environment. I think it'd be another one. Politics.
Well, there's a whole lot of topics represented there. We tried to cover kind of a really broad set of Wisconsin experiences, and you can sort it out in many different ways. We have five different sections, but there's a lot of cross themes that show up in other sections as well. So we tried to create a kind of rich experience with a lot of cross references.
Well, I tell you what, one part of this, Judith said, we got to have a little quiz. So we're going to have a quiz. Your chance to win two adult admissions to the Wisconsin Historical Museum in Madison. It's on the Capitol Square. We have two pairs of tickets to give out. And the question relates to something that you're going to see at the exhibit when you get there. So I'm going to read it for you now. I'm going to read the question for you now. And I'm going to ask you to email, right, Judith? We email the questions? Yeah, email or phone them. Phone or email in your answer, and we'll randomly pick a couple of names and of people who have the correct answer, and you'll get the tickets. So here's the question. Brothers James and William Horlick received a U.S. patent in 1883 for a nutritional supplement. It was for infants and invalids, and it was originally called Diastoid, and wondering what it is commonly known as today. So it was originally called Diastoid. What is it known as today? Call 1-800-642-1234, or even better yet, email your answer. That would even be the best. Email your answer to talk@WPR.org. It's talk@WPR.org. That way you'll help avoid full phone lines. And again, brothers James and William Horlick received a U.S. patent in 1883 for a nutritional supplement for infants and invalids. It was originally called Diastoid. What is it commonly known as today? Give you 10 minutes to get your answer in, and then we'll randomly select two of the right answers to get a pair of museum admission tickets each. So that's how we're going to do it. And I see there are people already, lots of people writing in. Seems like a lot of the inventions and discoveries featured in the exhibit have connections to the UW, which makes some sense, I would guess.
Yeah, the UW has been a kind of engine of innovation for at least 100 years. And probably the oldest story that we tell in this exhibit is about the Babcock test. Mm-hmm. Most people have heard of that, and that's maybe what we were thinking of primarily when we created the subtitle From the Iconic to the Unexpected. The Babcock test, for certainly anyone who is familiar with the dairy industry, is kind of a transformative invention. It's Stephen Babcock developed a technique of measuring the butterfat content in milk, which enabled the dairy industry to pay good dairy farmers what they were worth. It was a way to avoid skimming of milk or watering down milk and reward farmers who produced high butterfat milk for their efforts. And before that happened, you know, the industry wasn't really comfortable investing money because they couldn't control the quality of the output.
That's pretty cool. Did you guys get the film? There's a little film of Stephen Babcock explaining the Babcock test. Do you have that?
No, we don't have that, but the exhibit is going to be up for a long time, probably at least a year, and we're planning to add embellishments and improvements and changes over time. So that's something that we ought to track down and maybe add down the road.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting little film. It's only 5 minutes or 6 minutes long.
And the great thing about that, and something we try to do for our visitors, is most of them are not particularly interested maybe in the science of good mm-hmm. milk production. Mm-hmm. They just know, they like, when they open their gallon milk jug, that it's quality and it's good and they know what to expect.
Yeah.
And, you know, particularly with Babcock and here at the university, you know, that didn't come from just nowhere. This university was a major player in kind of standardizing quality dairy, both for producers and for the consumers. And that's kind of where we try to meet our visitors at.
And that makes perfect sense. And, you know, the UW, as we say, there are a lot of innovations from the UW, but there are also a lot that were just the work of enterprising individuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. I think another one of the iconic inventions is the Evinrude outboard motor.
Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting story because a lot of people have an idea that Ole Evinrude invented the outboard. And he didn't, in fact. The Evinrude outboard was not the first outboard motor, and it wasn't even the first that sold in volume. So that raised in my mind the question of how come everyone knows about this? You know, who gets mm-hmm. credit and mm-hmm. on what basis? And the answer that I came up with is just that Evinrude came up with a really solid, fabulous design. That it was simple, it was robust, it was powerful, and the same basic configuration of outboard motor is the standard today. And that's been over 100 years.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. Was there a heyday of Wisconsin innovation, or has it been kind of, I don't know, consistent throughout time?
Huh. I don't think you could say that there's a heyday. I think it depends on how you define innovation. We do have a lot of contemporary stuff in there, things that are maybe unexpected, like the Ironclad Lore, which was developed mm-hmm. by a guy from Wanakee who mm-hmm. was tired of freezing his fingers off ice fishing because he had to change his soft lure so often that it kept breaking. And he figured out how to develop a tough lure that would not break. And it was also, he decided to, after doing some marketing research from help at the UW Business School, figured out that there was an enormous quantity of plastic lures that were lost every year in American waterways. And he realized that that was a ton of plastics leaching chemicals into the waterways. So he developed an ironclad lure just a couple of years ago that mm-hmm. was both super durable and didn't contain any harmful plastics that would leach into the waterways.
Yeah. There's another one where he actually worked with the University of Wisconsin College of Engineering professors, a couple of professors from there, at least one for sure that I know of, and there's a worked together and came up with a great solution.
Yeah, and I particularly like that story because it brings together sort of three major themes in state history, and that's kind of concern for the environment, you know, sort of outdoor life, hunting and fishing, mm-hmm. and also the Wisconsin idea that the university should contribute to the public good.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking today about Wisconsin innovations from the iconic to the unexpected, it's what you're going to find when you attend the Wisconsin Historical Museum, where they have a great exhibit on. It's going to be on for quite a while now, so you're going to have a chance to see it. Talking with Dave Driscoll and Joe Kapler, who are both curators. Dave's in business and technology. Joe is with domestic life at the Wisconsin Historical Museum. Questions or comments, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question or a comment there. As long as we're on the sports, there was another one that I kind of thought was cool. Peter Harkin mm-hmm. Invented plastic ball bearings.
Well, not exactly. He used them. He applied them to
sailing
tackle. And that was a story that I just stumbled on when I started research on this. I was familiar with Gilson Incorporated out in Middleton, which has made medical devices for probably about 50 years. And I was talking to the president of the company, Robert Gilson, about the pipette man, which has kind of become a standard piece of lab equipment in the biological sciences since it was invented in 1972. And we do have examples of those in the exhibit. but Bob Gilson said, "You really need to call my friend Peter Harkin. He used to work here when he was attending the UW, and he developed this fabulous new kind of block for ice boats and sailboats while he was working here." And he apparently found these plastic ball bearings, which were going into a piece of Gilson equipment. Mm. He decided this is exactly what he needed for his ice boats. And he kind of built the first examples in the shop at Gilson. And a couple of years later, he sold some to friends. They won gold medals in the 1968 Olympics. and the design was so much lighter and had sort of was faster operating than existing steel bearing blocks that he got his arm twisted into going into business. And now Harkin Incorporated is one of the largest marine hardware companies in the world, headquartered in Pewaukee. I had never heard of it until Bob Gilson mentioned it.
That is absolutely amazing. So there is something worldwide significance right here in the state, and you're a guy who probably prides himself on knowing what's going on, and you didn't know.
That was actually one of the really fun parts of the exhibit research project, was coming up with these stories that were completely new to me. And that's kind of the other half of the title, the subtitle anyway, of the iconic and the unexpected.
Yeah,
so there are
absolutely
quite a few unexpected stories as well.
Joe, you're kind of curator of domestic life. What in the domestic life area surprised you?
In this show, the domestic life is kind of just a title. We're all kind of generalists, and yeah. Dave is helping him out on this project. He's kind of had the nose down into the heavy
to the
research.
Grindstone.
Absolutely. We'd love to do it, but it is time consuming. And I kind of worked with the bigger team, education staff, design mm-hmm. staff, marketing staff. And so I'm helping them out on this show. So there isn't necessarily a whole lot of domestic innovations that grab the headlines, but there are a few things, and I'll let Dave share the details on the innovation. Something we do often, dry our hair with a hair dryer. Mix food in a mixing bowl.
Well, it doesn't
bowl.
Look like you or I or any of the three of us do a lot of that with a hairdryer, but
maybe
Judith
back in,
might.
Maybe back in high school. Right. But there are dozens of in-home appliances and that have, at root, a fractional horsepower motor source. And that's another Wisconsin innovation that has that affected the daily lives of millions of people in this country and around the world.
And the inventor of the fractional horsepower motor was a fellow named Chester Beach from Racine, Wisconsin. And you're probably familiar with his name in the Hamilton Beach. He was founded that company as well as at least one other. He kind of developed it while working for a third. All of those small motor appliance companies were based in Racine, which until very recently was known as the small appliance capital of the U.S. because there were so many companies building appliances that had at their core a small high-speed electric motor. Drink mixers, blenders, hair dryers, engraving tools.
Very cool. Know,
on and on. And a lot of kind of household names that were developed in Racine. The Osterizer, the John Oster mm-hmm. company there, Dremel tools, small motorized engraving equipment.
That's amazing. Very cool. Dave Driscoll and Joe Kapler are guests today as we talk with them about Wisconsin innovations from the iconic to the unexpected. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Searce-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along as we talk with our two guests, Dave Driscoll and Joe Kapler, about Wisconsin's innovators, inventors, and I tell you what, we've got everything imaginable that was invented or maybe discovered here. It's really quite a list, and many of those things are at the Wisconsin Historical Museum in Madison on the square as part of a great exhibit. So I hope you'll have a chance to look at it. And I hope you have some questions. If you do, give us a call, 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. Jane in North Prairie.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Sure. I have something that I'm not sure is in your agricultural environmental category, but aquatic weed harvesters, those are those machines that we see working on our lakes in Wisconsin, cutting and removing the weeds. That's actually a Wisconsin product.
Huh.
Do you know what I'm speaking of?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I didn't know they were a Wisconsin product, though.
You bet. And our company actually manufactures them. We've been doing it for 47 years.
What's your company?
It's called Aquarius Systems.
Okay.
We're over in North Prairie. But the history is kind of a fun story. The original cutter boat was invented around 1903 or 1906 in Silver Lake, Wisconsin, by a man named Chester Hockney. And it all came about because of fussy housewives in Chicago. You know, remember in those days they had ice boxes, and we harvested a lot of ice here in Wisconsin. And those fussy Chicago housewives didn't like that ice box melting and weeds being having to be cleaned up in their ice boxes. So Chester invented a cutter boat to go in the autumn and knock the weeds down so that they could harvest clean ice. And it didn't take long for us to figure out that, you know, we can cut these weeds and clean up our lakes for recreational use as well. It's weird to think about why would this product come from Wisconsin? You know, why wasn't it invented in Florida or somewhere warm where there's lots of weeds?
Mm-hmm.
But we have all the lakes. We have the agricultural pressure on the lakes. And of course, all these companies that were able to make things to solve problems. Eventually, it became, turned into a weed harvester where we cut and collect the weeds. And now we've got hundreds working in Wisconsin all over the United States and in 40 countries around the world.
You know, that's a great story that I hadn't heard of at all. And it's something that I'm going to pursue for possible future acquisitions or updates of the exhibition. And it's kind of interesting that the weather was a factor there. It wouldn't have been developed in a place that didn't harvest ice.
Yeah,
there's at least one other kind of winter related story that we tell in the exhibition, and Joe was kind of made that happen. So I'll let him tell that story.
Now, Joe.
Well, sir, first of all, I just want to thank the caller for sharing it. And this is definitely part of the exhibition process. Once we kind of cut the ribbon, it doesn't end there. And a great thing about the opening events and tours that we give is hearing from our visitors. And we always hear of kind of updates to our story. Dave, as the caller was telling that story, Dave was over here fiercely scratching down names,
notes,
dates, and information, and that is exactly how we continually build the story of Wisconsin history. So thank you very much. The story Dave was referring to is something that is part ingrained of our culture, and snowmobiles. We call them snowmobiles today. Tooling around Wisconsin, Northwoods, down south, everywhere, on rivers and lakes. And that might be expected to know. You'd think, logically, a snowmobile would be invented in a cold weather state like Wisconsin, which embraces its outdoor weather. And this story comes out of a small town, Saner, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And Carl Eliason, he had a disability with his foot. Couldn't keep up with the guys when they were out in the woods. And he just got kind of that simple need drove him to think of, how can I get through these thick northern woods without walking quickly? And he didn't want to put skis on an old Model T, needed something smaller, more nimble, so he stuck a motor on a toboggan and invented the motor toboggan in 1924. And you look at it, and you sit up high, and you see these photos. You can these are all over the web on the Eliason site. It's spelled Eliason, pronounced Eliason. And just a wonderful Wisconsin story. Over the decades up in Saner, improved models, made them a little bit better, a little quicker. And we have in our front window at the Historical Museum, which faces Capitol Square, right where State Street meets the square in downtown Madison. We have an early 1946 motor toboggan. And, I know folks like to climb in their sleds today and go cruising. I don't know, when I look at that thing, if I'd want to jump on that and go cruising, you sit up kind of high, not a lot of protection. But it's a wonderful piece, and it was on loan to us from the Eliason family.
Wow.
And actually, I think that's an important point. We tried to tell stories from all over the state, and we had a lot of support from lending institutions, from museums and private individuals. About half of what's on display we have borrowed from other sources. Folks in Saner, up in Washburn, from Chippewa Falls, Racine, Milwaukee, Edgerton, Pewaukee, a lot of places on the state. And we couldn't have done this without a lot of help from other museums and private individuals.
That's a big part of our role. Not only do we collect and preserve, but we're also a venue. And where else could this story be told in the state other than the state's historical museum? And so I'm not sure it matters to visitors where these things originated from. They just love to see them and to learn the stories.
Well, they're all fascinating, that's for sure. And, you know, part of the story, or one of the stories, we posed as part of a contest, as a question and a contest here. James and William Horlick, I read at the beginning of the show, James and William Horlick received a U.S. patent in 1883 for a nutritional supplement for infants and invalids. It was originally called Diastoid. What is it commonly known as today? The answer, malted milk. And we have a couple of winners, and the two winners are Hope in Appleton and Luella in Sturtevant. So each of you will get a pair of tickets to the Wisconsin Historical Museum in Madison. Well, that's very, very cool. Glad we were able to do that. Scott in Sturgeon Bay, let's go to you now. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. I'm wondering if you have any, if part of your exhibit includes any information about the Cray Computing Firm in Chippewa Falls, and I've always wondered whether, I know they built supercomputers that are used by NASA and, you know, the Jet Propulsion Lab for research purposes in a variety of places, but I'm wondering if there was actually, if he was an innovator or if he just engineered existing parts and put together a bigger, faster machine in some way, and I'll take your response off the line.
All right, thanks. So, Dave Driscoll, comment?
Yeah, we do have a section on Seymour Cray and the supercomputer. One of my frustrations is that we couldn't fit an actual Cray 1 in the gallery. So what we have is a circuit board from a Cray 1 and some of Seymour Cray's original handwritten notes, his kind of architecture for the machine. And we've borrowed those from the Chippewa Falls Museum of Industry and Technology. And I guess it kind of depends on what you mean by innovation, whether, you know, Cray created something entirely new or whether he was sort of just incrementally improving on things. Certainly before he established his own company, when he worked for Control Data out of the Twin Cities, he was developing large scientific computers that were the fastest things going at the time. I think once he established Cray Research in Chippewa Falls, he didn't develop new components. In fact, he found kind of off-the-shelf and sort of bargain basement components. But what he was brilliant at is coming up with sort of new architecture, new structures, ways of accomplishing the task. And in some ways, he set himself an easy task. All he needed was blazing speed. He just needed to do a huge number of calculations per second. And that was really for just massive number crunching. He didn't really have to concern himself with portability or acquisition costs because his market was, basically government laboratories, people doing sort of weather forecasting or nuclear modeling, those kinds of things. So in a way, you know, what he was trying to do was very narrow and defined. But he did come up with kind of amazing engineering solutions to accomplish that. New ways of kind of wiring and organizing the structure of a computer. He developed liquid-cooled computers. I think his second version essentially used artificial blood as the kind of cooling fluid. So I think you'd have to say he was a brilliant kind of architect of computers, and I think he died in a car crash. I don't know how his career would have ended, because I think he was coming up on some of those practical real world issues. If you're planning to make 10 computers because that's all the market you thought in the world, and all of a sudden there's maybe 50 or 100 people, then you sort of, and competitors come in and you have to sort of start judging your cost and your sales price and that kind of stuff, which it got to be kind of tricky. And I think that wasn't Seymour's strength. He was really a computer architect.
Dave mentioned that we unfortunately couldn't fit a massive Cray 1 unit in the building. But other ways we tell stories through images. Images can be wonderful, and there's a nice photograph reproduced from the assembly of a Cray 1. And there's lots of people with what must be miles of wire. I guess by today's standards, we're used to a wireless world, and this wasn't that long ago. But it looks just so kind of archaic to our understanding of technology today. But that does speak to the complexity of it,
and that was one of his kind of architecture issues. If you look at a Cray 1, it's got this sort of large central unit and then what looks almost like a bench seat all the way around it. It's kind of a round thing. Mm-hmm. And it had that weird structure as opposed to just a standard box that most computers look like, because he wanted to minimize the length of wire that any electron had to pass down. So there's no stretch of wires more than 4 feet long in that whole device, and because of that, minimizing the travel time along wires, He came up with this completely new way of arranging a computer.
Klaus in Madison, it is your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for having my call. This is a great show, and specifically interesting to me. I'm the CEO of a new startup in Madison. And I guess my question has to do with once somebody in Wisconsin has made an invention, if your guests came across sort of standard modes that are specifically successful in Wisconsin for commercializing those inventions and bringing them to market. You know, we don't have the biggest venture capital community. We don't have the biggest access to capital. And so what are the standard ways that, or the most successful ways that people in Wisconsin have been able to bring their inventions actually to the marketplace and allow people to buy them?
Hmm. Good question.
That's an excellent question. And I know that's of kind of deep concern to the particularly the high-tech community, because there's a lot of really brilliant ideas that come out of the university, and the trick is, you know, moving them from the lab to the marketplace. I think one of the ways, particularly for university-based stuff, has been the Wisconsin Alumni Research Fund Foundation. And one of the stories in the exhibit is about Harry Steenbach and the invention of sort of irradiating food to increase
vitamin D
content. But I think, well, the stories that are represented in the gallery, and there's only about 40 of them, so we are not comprehensive in this respect. But an awful lot of them just are kind of right place, right time, enthusiastic entrepreneurs. The Evinrude story, apparently Ole's wife, Bess, was just really good with sales and advertising and kind of managed to land a couple of key contracts and kind of got the company off on solid footing. There's another kind of good story, the Desco Air Hat out of Milwaukee, a company that was founded in the 30s to produce diving equipment. And there's not a giant market for that. But in the 1960s, the company owner saw that in the Gulf Coast, divers were taking motorcycle helmets and sealing the face shield shut and running, you know, garden hoses down for air, and realized that there was probably a market for a new type of diving helmet. And so in 1968, he came up with the Air Hat. He sort of built it, prototyped it. We actually have his first prototype on display, along with a modern version of that was made this year. That's a little like the outboard motor in the fact that it was a really robust, solid design. It's been updated and improved since the late 60s, but it's still the worldwide standard diving helmet for diving in hazardous conditions. When people dive in nuclear fuel containment pools, they're wearing a Desco Air Hat made in Milwaukee. And I think they told me that only about a couple thousand a year they sell, so it's not a mass production activity at all. And the company is a few guys working out of a shop in Milwaukee. So it's not a question of a bunch of capital or investment or turning it around. It's a matter of, I guess, keeping costs low enough to supply the sort of limited but very specialized demand that there is in the world. I'm sorry, I can't actually give an ingenious answer to that. And if I did, I think...
if we did, we're going to be starting our own consulting business,
right. Actually.
A couple things from the kind of historian's perspective, because as much as we love to play exhibit developer, we're also historians really at heart. And you do get the benefit of perspective. And timing is a huge thing, and also I think I call it that simple brilliance, where after the fact, it looks so obvious. I can't believe I didn't think of that. And then being able to kind of doggedly push that. And the example I want to bring up in this case is Tom Blake. Who is Tom Blake? And he's probably one of the most important figures in modern surfing in the world. Tom Blake from Wisconsin. Who would have thunk it, right? Yeah. Very parallel story to Les Paul, born and raised, but moved out later once he kind of reached, you know, young adulthood and was known – or what he was known for, he did elsewhere, but he has Wisconsin roots. Tom Blake is actually buried in Wisconsin. He went out to California, fell in love with surfing, moved out to Hawaii, really developed a passion. These are big, heavy longboards, not accessible to a lot of people. What if we hollowed out the middle? And his innovation is first and probably most important is the hollow core surfboard. You know, a guy from Wisconsin, really? And yes, absolutely. And then he kept pushing that. He lived that. He believed that. He had other innovations, kind of the keel-like fin on the underneath side to better control. Better to control makes it more accessible. More people can surf. He kind of wrote the book on surfing. What year was that?
He patented that in, I should remember this, I think 1932.
Yeah, much earlier than you would think. And mm-hmm. And you see these photos from the 30s, and this guy is the beach bum prototype. You know, he looks like he's what you would, if you would go to Central Casting and say, get me a California surfing beach bum, this is what this guy looked like in the 1930s. He kept at it. He developed the camera housing for, waterproof housing for a camera. So all those great shots where you see from the surfboard up, and there's the mm-hmm. surfer hanging 10 with a big wave curling over the top, that comes back to Tom Blake. He had innovations in safety, paddleboard development as
right,
well.
Right, which were used for lifeguards all along the West Coast, and the American Red Cross actually bought his hollow core paddleboards to use in their life-saving programs across the country.
So the guy probably saved a bunch of lives and probably made a little bit of money then, too.
Well, it's interesting. In a way, he's a little like Stephen Babcock in that mm-hmm. he patented the hollow core surfboard, but he kind of gave away the idea. He wasn't interested in money. We have examples of build-your-own hollow surfboard plans that he published in Popular Mechanics and Popular Science. And he kind of was... I think he invented that kind of surfing lifestyle. He worked as a lifeguard, a movie stunt double, just enough to pay the bills and then go surfing in cool places. And was really about promoting surfing as just this really incredible, almost spiritual experience. And he wanted as many people to experience that as possible.
Well, we've just touched on a small minority of the topics that you're going to be able to see and look at and the innovations that you're going to be able to see and marvel at when you visit the Wisconsin Historical Museum. There's the exhibit's open now. It runs through next summer, doesn't it?
Runs for a year, and we have enough stories to fill two galleries. And we're going to work on kind of tightening up those stories and adding and editing. And we're going to see mm-hmm. some rotation of new content in and out. We know this is going to be good. It already is good with the audiences. And it's really great with school groups, too.
And there's an upcoming Wisconsin Public Radio event mm-hmm. at the museum, Tastes and Traditions of Wisconsin, WHA Radio and the Wisconsin Idea, sort of the title of that. And Randall Davidson, who is author of 9XM Talking, WHA Radio and the Wisconsin Idea. There's a dinner on, November 16th, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
And there's a whole string of events that are available that people can find on the website, correct?
Certainly on our website, wisconsinhistory.org, and then go to the museum link there. We have an events calendar right there, probably two clicks away. And we have a number of lunchtime lecture series. There's even one today starting fairly soon if you want to get up to – if you're out listening on the square. We have we have those regular kind of bi-monthly programs or twice a month.
Mm-hmm.
And we have these dinner events in the evening as well, and you can check that out on our calendar. I've been to a couple. Often I can't get in because these sell out.
Yeah.
Sure, and we want to make sure our visitors have a first crack at those. And these are a great way to kind of experience Wisconsin history, culture, and have a great time at the same time.
At the same time.
Yeah, 9XM was on our short list of Wisconsin firsts that we were considering for the exhibit. But they didn't make the first cut, and this is one way to make up for that, is to have a program about it.
Not every story can be told in a gallery with an object or an artifact or video. And some stories are better for books or articles or programs. And we look at the exhibit as the anchor to a much bigger program covering Wisconsin innovations.
Well, guys, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us. I'm going to be over there. I've got to get over and take a look. It sounds like fascinating.
Very good. I would love to have you. Give us a call. Certainly, before we get off the air, real quickly, I mentioned at the opening that we really rely on our support from the private sector, and certainly the lead gift of the Madison Community Foundation really got this project rolling. We appreciate that. American Family Insurance, the EVU Foundation, as well as ProMega. Here and Madison Gas and Electric and Wisconsin Public Radio has been a good partner with us as well. We certainly appreciate all of that.
Well, Joe, Dave, thank you so much. We'll look forward. We'll have to have you back and we'll do it again. Thank you. Sounds good.
Love to.
Thanks.
Dave Driscoll, Curator of Business and Technology. Joe Kapler is Curator of Domestic Life, both at the Wisconsin Historical Museum. Great to have them along. And we'll do it again. Go online, take a look at the website, and get over to the museum. If you're in the area, please do stop by the museum. You're going to really, really be amazed at what you're going to find there. And coming up, you may be amazed at some of the things that are going on in the social media area. Don Stanley joining us next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.